Mini episode 440 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.info.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge, mini episode number 440. I'm FDH Lounge managing partner Rick Morris coming at you today, coincidentally from the 440 in the suburban Cleveland area where I make my home, and preparing for a really great discussion with one of our favorite recurring guests on the program, somebody who always gets into outstanding political analysis with me, a little bit of political debate from time to time. There are very few people who can help you better break down the political scene than my man, Colin Delaney, the founder and editor of ePolitics. Go check it out at ePolitics.com. They've always got a host of tremendous publications up there. Sometimes the occasional e-book. They cranked out a really excellent one a couple of years back on the Obama campaign and some of the technological successes that they used in their 2008 presidential run. Colin is always just about the best person you can possibly talk to about things going on the political scene, sometimes also as it relates to technology, because that's kind of the specialty at ePolitics, is the intersection of politics and technology. And God knows there's an awful lot going on the political scene these days. We got the midterms coming up. I very deliberately did not want to restrict us to talking about the midterms. We're theming this discussion as the state of American politics going into the 2014 midterms, because in my estimation, there's a lot more interesting things going on than who's going to control Congress at the end of the November elections. We already know about the House of Representatives. That's a foregone conclusion for the first time in probably several midterms. The Senate is still a toss-up at this point, but again, not as much in play overall in terms of both races as in 2010, 2006, maybe even 2002. By the time we got to the fall, it looked like a Republican stampede, but over the summer, I don't think it was clearly a foregone conclusion the way that at least the House is now. So we're going to make this more of a broad discussion about all things going on the political scene right now, shaping us in 2014, and yes, maybe looking a little bit ahead to 2016. With that, bring in good friend of the show, Colin Delaney, ePolitics founder and editor. Pleasure to have you back in, as always, Colin. How are you today, my man?
Oh, I'm doing great, my friend. You almost make me sound like I know what I'm talking about.
Well, we may be differing on a few things through the course of this thing, but also probably agreeing in a couple of strange ways as well, as we always seem to do. We confound people with that sometimes, Colin. I know that's something you take pride in, as do I. These might be the least predictable political back and forth that you're going to find anywhere these days.
I have a great time talking with you, Rick, as always. And it is always fun to find the areas where we can get crossover. So let's see. But I do have to say, you know, nothing in politics is a foregone conclusion. Yeah, it's not an easy task for the Dems to try to take back the House. But, you know, my crystal ball broke a long, long time ago. And we don't know if the conventional wisdom is going to be right or not. I mean, obviously there are a lot of demographics, involved, where people live, how districts are drawn. In the last congressional election, Democrats got 1.5 million more votes than Republicans for in-house races, but the Republicans control the House by a wide margin. So there are, you know, a number of factors that contribute to it, but anybody who says they know what's going to happen is setting themselves up for a fall.
Well, that's very interesting, and that is very true, that the Democrats did get more raw votes in 2012. If nothing else, certainly that speaks to the amount of gerrymandering that happened after the 2010 races and the subsequent redrawing that came. I will tell you, here in the state of Ohio, and this is not the kind of gripe that you hear from your average Republican, but as we've established previously, I'm a very intellectually honest person. It's a disgraceful district that I am in. I'm represented by Marcy Kaptur, who had been the longtime representative from Toledo. You've probably seen this, Colin, you being a political junkie. They literally drew it like about 5 yards out from the Lake Erie shore, just to connect the western suburbs of Cleveland to Toledo, just to really gerrymander it in maximum position here. I think it's 12 Republicans, 4 Democrats, and that's the kind of shenanigans they had to do to get that. So when I look at it, though, and when I look at the gerrymandering that happened, to me, I'm a big believer in reading the body language of some of the principals involved here. Nancy Pelosi talking a big game in 2012 about getting back to House ASAP. This time around, not so much. Doesn't that tell you something?
Well, the last thing I'm going to do is take a politician's public pronouncements at face value, right?
Okay.
I mean, everything a politician said is calculated, you know, to achieve a goal. Do I think the Democrats are going to take back the House? I think there's a very slim chance. Should a Democratic leader do anything that might suppress turnout among Democratic voters, like negative talk? No, I don't think they should, because that's just bad politics. You know, in 2012, you know, again, the way the maps are drawn, and, you know, I tell you, my first substantive political experience was when I was 23 years old. It was a redistricting special session in the Texas legislature, and it was the first redistricting round after the 1990 census when computers had gotten good enough that you could really start slicing and dicing these districts down to the precinct level, the kind of thing you were just talking about they did to connect Toledo with Cleveland. That before technology, you know, you had to do this in a much broader brush, but now you can really get into a fine, fine thing. You know, in Austin, I'm not sure if it still is, but it was once divided so that it had tentacles going way far out into Texas Hill Country, all the way down to San Antonio, to make sure that Central Austin would not elect its own Congress member. And again, you could not have done that before technology.
Yeah, these are the kind of ways that, again, for as much as we celebrate it with all the gadgets that we have and the smartphones and the tablets and all the great stuff like that, yeah, the downside is how the political class in this country on both sides can use that and exploit that as they have. And as long as we're talking about control of Congress, let's stay there, because we got a real crunchy groove going on that subject right now. As far as it goes on the Senate side, I'm a big fan in any kind of way of looking at things, whether it be sports or other type of situations, of sort of looking at things in a paramutual kind of a way. If you were to be laying odds on somewhere in the 48 to 52 range as far as Republican seats for next time, I would think that would be the one most people would probably be betting on here, that it's going to be somewhere in there. It's unlikely that the Republicans are not going to gain any, but control of the Senate is far from a foregone conclusion. So it seems to me, though, we could be looking at an unprecedented situation. I'd like to know your thoughts on control of the Senate hanging in the balance, and particularly on one race. This deal in Louisiana, where a lot of times it will come down to a December runoff, if nobody gets 50% in this thing here, is Mary Landrieu not dead meat if it comes down to control of the Senate in December and it's basically a nationalized special election? In my mind, the Republicans only need to get to 50 seats in November with that one hanging in the balance. What do you think?
That's a good question. Unfortunately, I don't know enough about Louisiana politics, even though I was born right outside New Orleans. You know, Louisiana is a tough one to predict because the population shifts have been so great in the last few years, right? You know, you had the post-Katrina exodus. Now you have a lot of people returning to New Orleans, but it's a, you know, the average person who lives there now is wealthier, but you also have a larger Hispanic community than you used to. So, you know, I hate to say it, but everything comes down to turnout. And if you nationalize the election, then every Democratic field operative is also going to be rushing out there trying to turn out their segment of the vote. So I wouldn't say it's, if it goes to a runoff, I would not say it's a foregone conclusion that somehow Mary Landrieu loses. You know, the Landrieu family has a long history, for good or bad, right?
Yeah.
In Louisiana. So I wouldn't count her out. She's been counted out more times than once. You know, a couple of seats I think that are really interesting to look at, too, are Arkansas and North Carolina, two places that a lot of commentators thought were almost certain to go Republican. And yet, both Democratic candidates are doing pretty well. They may well both survive. We don't know. But that this sort of national narrative that doesn't take into account the actual, you know, quirks and demographics of the states themselves, I think that national narrative can miss a lot. And somebody was pointing out the other day that if a Republican wave, you know, a Republican wave could still happen in the fall, but it hasn't materialized yet. If it had materialized, then, seats in Alaska and Arkansas and North Carolina would be already a done deal, and they're not.
Absolutely. Now, that's a great point, and I will agree with you as an analyst in the sense that I think that the Democrats in just about all of these places have achieved about as highly as they could on candidate selection. Now, of course, in North Carolina, Kay Hagan is an incumbent, but as is Mark Pryor in Arkansas. But in the other places, like Kentucky and some of the other seats that are up for grabs, they seem to have done pretty well on that. But I'd like to ask you about this. I'm sure you're a little bit bemused as a Democrat in looking at this. The notion that, and we've been talking about this, I think analysts have for a long time now, that the 2014 Senate midterms are largely going to be conducted in the red states, Republican turf, because what happens with these vulnerable Democrats here, that's what's going to control it. Do enough of them hang on? Are there enough of them to get picked off? For once, maybe not nationally still, probably never again nationally, but at least this year, the environment is a Republican plus issue, is it not? You look at Mary Landrieu in Louisiana with the oil and gas industry, Begich up in Alaska, same thing, oil and gas. Allison Grimes in Kentucky having to attack the president on the coal issue. It's really interesting that what may be true on a national level of where Democrats poll better on the environment, it does seem to be one of the bigger albatrosses they have this year on a state-by-state basis, is it not?
Well, I mean, what's the oldest rule? All politics is local. The coal thing I find absolutely fascinating because nobody works in coal mines anymore. They're automated. I'm not saying nobody. But a mine that might have employed, 1,000 people or 10,000 people a few decades back now might employ, a few hundred at most. So, it's not the Obama administration that's killing coal. It's robots and natural gas that are killing coal. A lot of liberals would like to get rid of coal, but I think market forces are doing a pretty good job of that, on their own. Or the robots are killing coal employment. Natural gas is killing coal, period. As I said at the start of this, this particular rant, that all politics is local. And, the way candidates always have to pivot, in some way to, work with the local dynamic. If they work against the local dynamic, they're, almost certain to lose. So it shouldn't be a surprise. I mean, Louisiana is an oil and gas state, absolutely. So, Democratic politicians have long been in the pocket of the oil industry there. It's really hard to get around that. And, it's why the Democratic Party actually has a pretty broad range of opinions. You can have energy state people like Landrieu, and then you can also have, people like my friends at the Chesapeake Climate Action Network who are trying to get rid of fossil fuels entirely. And we can all live under the same tent.
It is a very interesting coalition, and it's one that, again, as you pointed out, that does have, particularly in times like this, its own share of internal contradictions, which really makes things a lot more interesting. And in terms of the broader electorate, I'd like to get your thoughts on Obamacare. There have been some interesting rulings this week that have come down either way on that, and it looks like that's going to be fought out in the courts for a long time to come as far as appeals go on the various elements of it. But as a political issue, it sort of strikes me at this point now that maybe the whole thing might be kind of a wash. And that's not to say that the Republicans aren't going to benefit this year, because like I said, I'm certain personally they're going to hang on to the House. I would guess they're probably better than average odds on taking the Senate. But I don't know how much Obamacare is going to have to do with that, because obviously it energizes the base and it gets them out. But again, you've got the thing now of where now that Obamacare is in place, some people are now finally, at least in their mind, getting something from it, getting from Obamacare what it is supposed to produce for them. It's continuing to have the snafus, but on the other side, Ted Cruz hates it, and he's pretty much more unpopular than gonorrhea since doing the filibuster against the last fall and shutting down the government. So what are your thoughts? Am I wrong on thinking that it may all be kind of a wash one way or another as a big cutting issue this year?
Well, I think when it comes to the broad electorate, there's a lingering, I think there is, you got to remember this thing was attacked, you know, in the most brutal and negative terms for years. And, you know, a lot of the mainstream media coverage just kind of parroted those attacks. So people have received a one-sided view of Obamacare, which, I know no one who's going to defend it as an efficient way, right, to get health care to millions of people who haven't had it before. I mean, it's a kludgy bill, but it was, like everything else in politics, the best you can get that week, you know. A lot of Democrats wanted single payer, Medicare for all, but the White House made a calculation that that wasn't going to be possible. So this is the route we went down. But in any case, you know, I think for broad middle America, it sort of plays into this Obama, you know, sort of Obama being in the doldrums now. It's one of many different things that, that contributes to this kind of, I'm not going to use the word malaise, but I ain't getting into, man. But, you know, the 6 year of his presidency, he's lame duck, lame duck in the making. A lot of things just still aren't going great. I think a lot of the international stuff, hurts him, even though how he's supposed to have control over a Russian-made, surface-to-air missile launcher is beyond me. But so I think Obamacare plays into that general negativity. On the conservative side, it definitely fires up the troops, right? This is going to help get Republican voters to the polls. On the Democratic side, I have a lot of friends who are working hard to mobilize people. One thing is, I think you pointed out that people receiving the benefits, it starts to spread out. But it's not just the people who get the benefits. It's their cousins, right? It's the people they work with. It's that people see all of a sudden, my God, you haven't been able to go to a doctor in a decade, and now you're able to start treating your diabetes, right? That you can begin to see the benefits. And, that leaks out. But that doesn't turn people out to vote, right? So, as far as the enthusiasm goes, it may still be a net plus for Republicans. Although, like I said, I have plenty of friends on the Democratic side who are trying to change that.
That makes sense. I think that I would certainly agree with that, that it does create an enthusiasm gap that benefits the Republicans. So even if it's a wash in terms of polling, in terms of turning out bodies, you're probably right on that, I would guess. But as far as it goes with Obamacare, and I don't remember what the specific issue was previously. On a previous time you were on the show, you and I were talking about this, or maybe we were talking more broadly about some of your dissatisfaction with Obama and not being daring enough on some of these policy fronts. And I remember saying to you at the time, I really think he's with you on these things. He's getting as much as he feels that he can get. And I know we had another discussion when we were talking about gay marriage, and where I said he was in favor of it in Illinois, then said he wasn't in favor when he ran for office. The true Obama has always been in favor of gay marriage. So I look at it kind of similarly here, and this is kind of a conspiracy theory, but I wonder if you join me in subscribing to it, which is Obama, when he was in Illinois, I believe was a proponent of single payer. I don't think he's ever changed on that. As you said, he knew he couldn't get it through. But I almost kind of wonder, all the chaos that's happened, now it's not going to happen in his administration. We're not going to move to single payer. But if he's a true believer on the left, what matters to the true believers is that it gets done eventually. I think some of these parts of the chaos and the internal contradictions of it, to him, I think they're a feature, not a bug, and that they will pave the way, in his mind at least, for single payer down the road. Your thoughts on my wacky conspiracy theory?
It's wacky. Yeah, no sane politician would wish on themselves what Obama has gone through over the Affordable Care Act.
Okay.
Yeah, no one has a crystal ball. No people can try to play these kind of long games, but pragmatic politicians, and it's hard to call Obama more than anything other than pragmatic. His liberal allies would say far too pragmatic. No one would wish on themselves what we have all been through. I was in the room at a liberal organization that had been working on the Affordable Care Act for years when the Supreme Court decision, affirming it, came down 2 years ago, and the amount of relief in the room, you could not quantify the amount of relief in the room. It was so intense. that, you know, anyone who takes a realistic view of the healthcare system and looks at other countries can see that something resembling single payer is far more efficient. I mean, Medicare is single payer, right? It has administrative costs averaging around 3%. The market-based healthcare system has administrative costs averaging around 20%. And that's because, well, a number of reasons, but one of the main reasons is that the companies have spent so much time and money trying to deny coverage to people, you know, trying to say, oh, we don't cover that. But that no sane policy analysis would say you go for a kludgy, you know, market-based system over single payer, other than political considerations of passing it. But they were completely focused on, you know, remember, people have been trying to get this done since the late 40s, and their administration was completely focused on getting it done. I don't think they were focused on an ultimate ideological goal. They were trying to achieve this, you know, major advance in the way Americans care for each other.
Well, I appreciate, if nothing else, the great soundbite of you immediately pronouncing that as being a wacky idea there. We like to go for entertainment on the program, so if that's your opinion, I appreciate you making it as entertaining as possible, because, you know, that's what allows us to do the dry policy analysis like that, is that if you're going to shoot me down right away and give the audience a laugh there. But as far as shoot down go, and in a more serious sense, you referenced it before, the unfortunate airplane incident there going down in eastern Ukraine last week. It does contribute to it. Again, while you didn't want to use the word malaise, I would use it without much sense of hesitation right now. And I would guess, and this may not sum up where you're at, but I would guess that probably a majority of the American public is probably where I'm at on these issues, which is, again, you know, contrary to what the Hugh Hewitts of the world will tell you, obviously Obama inherited a bad international situation in 2009 all the way around. Having said that, by the way, if not for Iraq, he's not elected president in the first place, so let's not cry for him. He would have nothing to run against and beat Hillary Clinton on were it not for Iraq. So
if it weren't for Iraq, George Bush might well not have won a second term.
Well, that's interesting, too. Well, you know,
Before, if you go back and look at public opinion and legislative achievements and all that in the summer of 2001, until 9/11, George Bush was well on his way to being a one-term failed president.
It was not going well. You're right about that. Having said that, if he just limited it to Afghanistan instead of Iraq, I disagree with you. I think George Bush wins probably with 56-57%. I don't think it's even a race in 2004, if not for the self-inflicted wound of Iraq.
If it's not for 9/11, right?
Oh, well,
provided the justification.
Right.
The Chinese of the world wanted to go into Iraq the whole time. They may well have found a justification. Yeah. But if it weren't for what happened in the early fall or late summer of 2001, that's why counterfactuals are so difficult in politics, because you have to account for all the variables.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that if you're taking 9/11 out of it too, and as much as I love counterfactuals, that's one of the hardest ones I think I've ever thought of. So on the spot, I couldn't even give you an opinion of whether it would have helped him or hurt him. If you're saying 9/11, yes, but Iraq, no, I think Bush wins in a landslide. If you take them both out of it, I don't know. But that's really interesting. But, yeah, no question about it. Iraq got Obama elected once, maybe even twice, but certainly once anyway. So nobody should cry too much for him in terms of what he inherited. But I think the vast majority of the American people would, not vast, at least over 50% would agree with me, inherited a bad hand, not playing it real well at the moment. When the world is on fire in as many spots as it is right now, between ISIS, between Israel/Gaza, between Ukraine, and again, you look at the whole thing with the reset policy with Russia. I mean, I'm not going to channel Mitt Romney and say biggest geopolitical foe, but, you know, they were really playing up the whole reset with Russia thing. So you don't get to have it both ways when things go sour and Putin shows you the other side of it. I think he, you know, has humiliated Obama just as he did Bush, who famously peered into Putin's soul back in 2001. So I think it's two presidents in a row that he's humiliated. So I don't think the American people are happy.
What would you have him have done? You know?
At what point? In terms of the reset or?
Well, we live in a world where countries have to get along. So whether or not you personally think Putin is a jerk, a dictator, whatever, you have to pursue the diplomatic avenues in front of you if you want to get anything. You know what I mean? And when it comes
I'm a big anti-militarist on the Republican side. I'm not a militarist, so again, I'm not out there with Lindsey Graham and the rest of those lunatics. Because I'm a decided Rand Paul type. But again, in terms of maybe you don't get carried away with the schizophrenia of reset, you're going to be our best friends. And then when things go bad, you look like a moron. Maybe you try to play it a little bit closer to the middle the whole way and not get caught up in the mood swings, I think.
Well, let me just put it this way. Carrying on diplomacy in an internet age is extremely difficult because the kinds of messages that countries used to send each other that were often very coded, not coded literally, but coded in the sense of you say nice things in public, just like senators always say the nicest things about each other when they're all in the same room. The things that you have to say to make diplomacy work don't play well to an audience at home necessarily.
Yes.
You know, this is just a simple fact of the modern world. We have very few levers of power over Russia. You know, they don't depend on us for anything economically, really. I mean, you know, the banking system, that kind of thing, the things that we, you know, that the sanctions are trying to get at. But we don't share a border with them. We can't cut off their natural resources in any way. Putin can pretty well, unless we're willing to launch bombers, Putin can do what he wants.
And Sarah Palin would disagree about the border. Sarah Palin would say you're forgetting about a border.
Good point. I shall cross the Bering Sea myself on foot.
Well, my sense of this was what I was building to was I don't think it's really going to cut, though, again, unless it's a general perception of malaise with Obama. But if that's the case, then it will cut, but it would be a part of other things as well, like the IRS thing with the hard drives getting wiped out and everything like that. But I don't get the sense in and of itself foreign policy is going to make much of a pullable dent in the midterms. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, except as we discussed, just kind of affecting the background noise. But no, if we were to launch a disastrous war, or remember the Carter rescue operation that went so badly wrong. You know, if something like that were to somehow happen, it could change things. I mean, a little over 100 days is still an eternity in politics. Plenty of things can happen. But no, I think it just fits kind of into the background for most people. One thing that I wonder about is, you know, the economy has been steadily improving by most measures, but people don't really seem to feel it, you know. And will that start to sink in? Will the fact that unemployment is down, that there are fewer people, there are fewer layoffs, that, you know, inflation is still low, that businesses are beginning to grow again, will that begin to sink in or not? I think that'll have a much bigger effect. But from a campaigner's point of view, it's can you reach your voters with the right message to get them motivated to actually show up? Because this is going to be a low turnout election almost certainly.
Well, what I'm going to say about the economy is going to sound very cynical, but I'm going to say I think it was the same thing that was happening with Bush. If you remember the years of like 2003 to 2007, we kept hearing about how all the successes were underreported. Larry Kudlow practically made a career at that point out of claiming that. I think, again, people are looking at, when you look at the underemployment numbers, when you look at the number of people that are not counted as being unemployed anymore because they've fallen off the unemployment rolls, I'm not sure I can fit on one hand all the people that I know that applies to. So I think people are looking at it like the government jimmies up these numbers. They do it under both parties. So I think that's what it is, too. I would guess people are just getting more sophisticated about the games that the government plays to make the economy look better.
Well, if you're going to tell me that the policy professionals who are career civil servants, not political appointees, who run the Bureau of Labor Statistics, are cooking the books, I'm going to ask you to provide the evidence. because they do talk about things like participation in the labor force. You know, those numbers are quantified. You can say that they're
wrong. No. I hear you on that, but here's the thing, though.
You got to have evidence, man.
All right, I don't have any hard evidence on it, but I will tell you again, it's documented out there about the people that have fallen off the rolls. Participation in the economy by able-bodied adults is like, what was it, like a World War II low or something like that? I mean, it's the lowest it's been in decades. So for people to sense, we haven't
pulled.
Right.
And a lot of that's early retirement. You know, Obamacare makes it easy to retire, easier to retire a little earlier. You know, again, the biggest thing that I worry about with employment is the long-term unemployed. That is a higher number than we've seen. You know, it's a higher percentage. But a lot of that,
and they're not counted on unemployment. That's my point.
Oh no, they're still. Bureau of Labor Statistics still counts this.
But it's a separate number. It's not the 6.9 or whatever it is. It's a separate number. You have to dig through the headlines to find. And I guess that's my point. Is if people know that the number that's getting put out there is not the important number. That's the number we all talk about, but that number to me is pretty worthless. It doesn't capture what's really going on with the economy. I think that's what people are starting to figure out. And they're looking at these other numbers you and I are talking about that give a more accurate representation of what's going on.
It's certainly possible. I don't know for sure, right? Because there are a lot of different numbers out there. There are the job loss and growth numbers, right? How many jobs created, how many jobs lost in a given month.
Right.
You know, those have been swinging much more positive over time. The unemployment rate itself doesn't count people who have stopped, you know, looking for work actively.
Yes,
that kind of thing.
Exactly.
That's certainly true. To me, though, you know, the big problem with the long-term unemployed is that there are structural changes going on in the economy, for better or for worse, that are just leaving whole categories of people trapped. You know, they're up in the air. They've got nothing to depend on. You know, the medium wage, low to medium skilled construction jobs are going away. The highly skilled jobs are there. My older brother, for instance, runs a small manufacturing shop in Austin. He's got one employee, and he does small manufacturing runs for things like parts they need 80 of for offshore oil rigs, things like that. He is going like gangbusters. His hardest problem is finding people that can, you know, actually show up for work on time, you know.
Right.
But again, he's a highly skilled guy. It's the people that had, you know, the $10, $12, $15 an hour jobs in factories that, it's a cold economic calculation when to replace that person with a robot. And once that job's been replaced by a robot, it doesn't come back to a human.
Exactly. You know, and when you talk about early retirement, and again, this is anecdotal when I say I know a guy, but I know a guy that had that happen, and I think he was like 62 at the time and didn't want to retire then, took a much less lesser package than he would have otherwise, but was downsized, probably partially due to age. So there's when you talk about early retirements, there's certainly a lot of them that are not exactly voluntary as well. So it is, you know, still out there in way too many places, unfortunately, still a gruesome landscape today, which, speaking of gruesome landscapes, I understand that you were in Detroit for the... you like my segue there? For the
Nicely
Netroots...
Nicely done, yeah.
Thank you. For the Netroots Nation conference here, which is always one of the more interesting parts of the political year. So I understand there was a lot going on there in terms of a lot of chatter of Warren for president, that good old Pocahontas there was getting a big standing ovation from the crowd, and a little draft movement there to try to get her to reconsider and run. So I'm curious, from you being there, some of the main points of conversation between that, Uncle Joe Biden, with Hillary as well, with her relationship both with the Netroots, as she did not go to this thing, her relationship with the Obama administration, which continues to be a source of ongoing fascination leading up to 2016. What were some of the big top-line things that were on people's tongues at this conference?
Well, let me just say that Elizabeth Warren, I can't say everyone, that's a bit of a broad statement, but people love Elizabeth Warren. She's to the heart of why people get involved in progressive politics in the first place, that we want to make the world a better place. We want to expand opportunity to more people. We want to expand, you know, inclusion to more people. because I was going to misquote a friend of mine, so I won't do it. But a good buddy of mine was actually, working hard for Warren behind the scenes. There was a small group of people at the conference. And just so people know, Netroots Nation is, it started out as a blogger conference, but now it's basically a conference of several thousand liberal/progressive organizers and activists. So it skews younger, but there are quite a few people with gray hair there as well. But there was a strong cadre of people who would really love to see Elizabeth Warren run. And then there are a whole lot more like me who like her and really enjoy having her in the Senate. That it was vocal but not broad support for her running for president. There was a lot more. The Ready for Hillary stickers were getting snatched up.
Interesting.
And then Biden, personally, but, he's Uncle Joe. The thing about him is actually, I don't know if you've ever talked about Onion Joe Biden, which is the version of Joe Biden that lives in, the pages of The Onion. The first story, I think, was shirtless Joe Biden washes Trans Am in White House driveway.
I've got that in one of my Onion books. That's awesome.
I love it. Onion Joe Biden is a fascinating character because, it reveals what we want Joe Biden to be. But
right.
I think if he runs for real, he's just too hard to take seriously. He's going to go down as having done more than any politician probably to advance marriage equality because it was his initial, he basically nudged Obama into coming out, so to speak, in public as being in favor of gay marriage, right? So, he'll have that. Biden has that. And he has a lot of goodwill among the LGBT community because of that. But him against Hillary, it's really not he'll just get – it just won't happen. Now, a lot of us want Hillary to be primaried. We don't want her to waltz to a nomination because that leads to a weak candidate in the fall. The primary battle between Clinton and Obama in 2008 made Obama a far better candidate and made his operation far stronger than it would have been if they'd faced no serious opposition. So, there's a sense that you don't want Hillary to just walk away with it, particularly because she ran such a bad campaign last time, right? Like she's got to prove that she can run a campaign that doesn't end with people just sniping at each other all over the place. I mean, it was a poisonous atmosphere inside her leadership last time.
That's a great point. And absolutely, and to be sure, there's no question about it. My boy Rand Paul will be very battle-tested by the time he comes to my hometown of Cleveland to take the Republican nomination in 2016. You're absolutely right to fear the effects.
Seriously, though, let's talk about Rand Paul and Rick Perry, because I think that discussion is fascinating.
It is.
It's one of the few serious policy debates going on in public right now in the country.
It is, and again, it's one that's based on just pure demagoguery on the part of Rick Perry, and it's something that I've talked about with you previously on the show, me, of course, being a proud paleocon, and of saying, and this continues to be true, the Republican Party has to come to grips with, again, even with the world being on fire right now, it's not like on foreign policy that the public is clamoring in the polling for the Republicans to come back, because Iraq is and continues to be an open wound on the party. They denied it in 2012. They went with an unreconstructed George W. Bush guy/opportunist in Mitt Romney, and it went exactly the way that I said that it would, and it will go exactly the same way. I will tell you what, too. There's a lot of people like me. I believe there are. Going to be the last straw for us as registered Republicans. We'll never become Democrats, maybe registered independents. If Rand Paul loses the nomination because they're getting demagogued on foreign policy, that is a big danger flashpoint, I think, because there's a lot of people that's going to be the last straw for them. That is really, really something that they need to watch. This is not just politics as usual on this foreign policy debate. If it becomes just the demagoguery of you people are peace sticks and you want the same foreign policy as Obama and blah, 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 that's going to run a lot of people out of the party, Colin.
I think that's a very interesting point. You talk about becoming independent. The pollsters will talk about, independent voters skewing this way and that way. One thing that they have to take into account in their voter modeling is that an independent voter now is not necessarily the same as an independent voter of 15 or 20 years ago, because so many Republicans have sort of, you know, the Tea Party wing has gone in one way, and a lot of the old Northeastern Republicans, you know, they're not really becoming Democrats yet, give time, maybe, but, you know, they have sort of veered over into an undefined middle where, you know, a higher percentage of people than did, say, 15 years ago will now self-identify as Democrats. So, you know, that's, you know, always you have to watch polls carefully to make sure that they're modeling, you know, that sort of change that's going on. Now, another change that I wonder about is, you know, historically through the, like, U.S. history, evangelicals kind of stayed out of politics up until the 1970s, 1980s, that it was sort of a render unto God what is God's and unto Caesar what is Caesar's mentality. I wonder if we will shift back to the historical norm, or if evangelicals will continue to be as involved in right-wing politics as they have.
That's a great point, and I guess I'll bring it full circle on that. I'll give my opinion on it as well, and I'm interested in yours. I would guess, as somebody who is a social conservative and who looks at the landscape, that mm-hmm. with the exception of abortion, where, again, that is still a contested issue, that is still one with real ramifications, although I think a lot more social conservatives like myself are waking up to the fact that the Republican Party only ever pays lip service on this and really doesn't go balls to the wall on trying to get five Supreme Court justices. It's more so just a wedge issue, unfortunately, mm-hmm. for the Republicans. But on gay marriage, for us social conservatives, that battle is lost. And it is shocking how it's, I mean, in less than 20 years, and really more like 15 years, there have been very
more
few
like
things
five.
Like that.
Yeah,
yeah,
like
well,
5 years, yeah.
I trace it back to, again, you know, and Joe Biden, typical foot-and-mouth thing, where it came off where he was talking about, quote-unquote, Jews in Hollywood, but where he was crediting the entertainment industry at one of these things, and between Ellen's TV show and Will and Grace, I think mm-hmm. that did a lot to turn around people culturally on it, to pave the way for something like this. I think you may be right on this, because gay marriage won't even be a political issue, I don't think, a decade from now. It will be that for people mm-hmm. like myself that believe in traditional marriage, mm-hmm. we're going to not like it but not be able to do anything about it. I don't think it will even be an issue. So I think you may be right, because, you know, there's just going to be a lot of dispirited people saying on everything except abortion, and even abortion's not going so well from the social conservative point of view. Mm-hmm. All these battles are basically lost. The 60s generation won, Colin, in my estimation.
Interesting, interesting. I don't know if I'm going to go quite that far. I would just say that, you know, to misquote or paraphrase Martin Luther King, that the arc of history is long, but it bends towards justice. In this case, it bends toward equality. You know, that, the quote that my friend Joel said, you know, in a closing statement at Netroots was, our definition of family values is that every member of our family has value, right? So that, you know, gay rights, gay equality, and look, I grew up in rural East Texas. You know, when I moved to D.C. and saw two guys kiss in public for the first time, that was not exactly an easy thing for me just to go, oh, that's normal. You know what I mean? So, you know, I went through a personal, you know, I was liberal as the day is long, but I went through a personal transformation on what I saw as normal behavior. You know what I mean? And I tell my gay friends this, and, you know, they have seen it with other, you know, straight guys as well, straight people as well. But, yeah, sort of that, you know, when the Constitution was written, you know, only 10% of the country could vote, probably, white men with property. And we've just sort of steadily expanded our sense of who is America and who is American. And it's us, regardless of what we look like or who we sleep with.
It has definitely been going in that direction, and will continue to be going in that direction. I would guess that would be a consensus of anybody's political forecast at this point. But with all the sand, unfortunately, I haven't gone out of the hourglass here, and always quicker than I might hope for when we were having this conversation with you, Colin. But a great one, and again, I think it just points out that if certainly no later than the end of the midterms, but at some point in the near future, look forward to getting you back on and breaking it down more, because there's never enough time to be able to do this. Our good friend Colin Delaney, founder and editor of ePolitics, ePolitics.com. Thank you so much for your time today, my man.
It's been a great pleasure. Enjoyed it as always.
I did too. I know that the listeners did as well. Thank you all, everyone, for joining us today for mini episode number 440 of the FDH Lounge.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, All Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.